It's a great speech. Well, here's a response. Reason not the need. Our basest beggars are in the poorest things superfluous. Don't talk to me about what I need. If you want to start talking about need, what I really need, none of us needs much of anything. It's possible to live in Minnesota in November without the heat on. You'll stay alive. There's no need to have the heat on. I can go into Washington D.C. and find the bag lady who's walking the streets with nothing but her overcoat and her stocking cap and her two bags stuffed with a newspaper. And I can say to her, you don't need any of that. You certainly don't need those shopping bags stuffed with newspaper. They're gone. Boom. You don't need that stocking cap. You'll still survive. Boom. It's gone. Okay. And the coat, you don't need that coat. But I don't have a home. Well, you don't need a home. What do you think the subway grates are for? Warm air comes up from them. You'll be fine. Boom. There goes the coat. Our basest beggars are in the poorest things superfluous. You don't need all that stuff. You may have nothing, but that little you've got, you don't need it. If we're going to start playing the need game, you don't need any of it. Allow not nature more than nature needs. Man's life is cheap as beasts. You want to get down to need? You want to talk about what we need to stay alive in nature, but please notice how he's using the word now. His daughters have redefined the word for him. It's no longer nice human nature and offices of nature. It's now just simply staying alive. They're redefining the terms of the play. Allow not nature more than nature needs. Man's life is cheap as beasts. What do you need? Well, maybe a little shelter sometimes. And you don't need clothes. The animals don't have clothes. And the food, you can just sort of find it out there. There's stuff to eat, you know. Eat some grass. Grab a chunk of bark off the tree. It'll keep you going. It's a horrifying vision. It's an absolutely horrifying vision, but I'll tell you, it was our century that comes down to actually doing this. Whenever I teach Lear, I keep going back to Solzhenitsyn. The Gulag Archipelago. And Solzhenitsyn's description of what life in those slave labor camps was like. And the fact that they barely had clothing to wear. They wrapped little strips of felt around their feet. They would then be marched 10 miles at 5 o'clock in the morning in 20 below zero weather, work for 12 hours, not having eaten anything, be marched back 12 hours later, walk the 10 miles, be given a little bowl of snow soup, then go and lie down on a board covered with lice, sores all over them, and then this would go on 7 days a week because they were Marxists. They didn't observe Sunday. Until suddenly, indeed, one somebody walking behind you would fall down, and as Solzhenitsyn says, how easy it is to die. The man is walking beside you, and oh, he's gone. You go to rouse someone in the morning, and oh, you pull him out of his bed, he's gone. And that was the view of the Marxist state. These weren't good citizens. These weren't good workers. Therefore, they were animals, and you treat them like animals. But Solzhenitsyn's point was, it was amazing how many survived. Why? Because you don't need much to survive. It's horrifying. Allow not nature more than nature needs. Man's life is cheap as beasts. You'll survive. You may be an animal, but you'll survive. You may live an animal's life, but you'll survive. Thou art a lady, Lear says. If only to go warm were gorgeous, why nature needs not what thou gorgeous wearest, which scarcely keeps thee warm. You're wearing your pretty gowns that are revealing all that flesh. They're not keeping you warm. You don't need them. Get rid of them. But for true need, you heavens, give me that patience. Patience I need. And the old king cries out for a virtue, calling for patience. Breaks your heart. These tiny little moments when he keeps learning, and yeah, he's going to lose everything else, but he realizes what he genuinely needs now is to be able to get through this, to endure. And it's a recognition of the situation in which he finds himself. You see me here, you gods, a poor old man, as full of grief as age, wretched in both. If it be you that stirs these daughters' hearts against their father, fool me not so much to bear it tamely. Touch me with noble anger, and let not women's weapons, water drops, stain my man's cheeks. No, you unnatural hags. I will have such revenges on you both that all the world shall. I will do such things. What they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. You think I'll weep? No, I'll not weep. Kaboom! The storm bursts overhead. I have full cause of weeping, but this heart shall break into 100,000 flaws, or I'll weep. Oh, fool, I shall go mad. And he runs out into the storm. If the man had written nothing else other than that single speech, he'd have been immortal. Cornwall says, after that, let us withdraw, 'twill be a storm. Regan says, this house is little, the old man and his people cannot be well bestowed. Goneril says, 'tis his own blame, hath put himself from rest and must needs taste his folly. Very calm, very controlled, and absolutely heartless. Completely without human sympathy. But they're warm and they're well-dressed, and undoubtedly they're going to have a nice meal that night. They have all the creature comforts, and they are completely uncivilized. They are indeed animals. We're going to run out onto the heath now with Lear and Edgar and the fool, who are going to have to live like animals, who begin asking the real questions, who in fact become more like men, because suddenly they're having to examine philosophically, what's it all mean? Why are we here? What's going on? Okay. Before we get to that, though, I need to take a few moments. I want to look at the big speech in the storm, Lear's big speech in the storm, Act 3, Scene 2. I just mentioned the first line last night. This is emblematic of the whole play. This really is the center, the focus, the core of the whole play. Lear against the storm. The storm is, if you will, an external representation of what's going on inside Lear. He prefers to be out in that storm rather than being inside. He chooses to run out. They're glad to have him go, and they lock the door against him. But they're glad he's gone. There wouldn't have been room for him anyway. But it's also what's going on inside of his head. I mean, the real storm is taking place inside. But he rushes out into it, and as I said last night, he begins giving orders. He becomes more king-like. Blow winds and crack your cheeks, rage, blow. Although it's wonderful if, and I wish we had the time, we could go through all the poetry, but please note, blow winds and crack your cheeks, rage, blow. It's a foot short. It's not iambic pentameter, it's iambic tetrameter. And even as he's out there trying to be majestic, the poetry he's speaking has lost a foot. A foot has fallen out. There's something missing. There's something missing. The image is a powerful one. He is being majestic. He's giving orders to the storm, but even the orders are about destruction. Blow winds and crack your cheeks. Blow so hard, create such a huge storm that you blow your cheeks apart. They used to have these on the old maps. You've probably seen them in the corner. Drawings of the winds blowing with the big puffed out cheeks. If you crack your cheeks, of course what happens is you can't blow out through the lips anymore. The cheeks are destroyed. There can't be any air coming at all. It is a call on the winds to blow until the point where they destroy themselves. And this speech is seeking destruction. It's destruction in nature. The king who has destroyed civilized order is now calling on nature, which is all he has left to him, to destroy itself. Because recognizing his own folly, he is now calling for universal destruction. He is longing, if you will, for the apocalypse. He's longing for it to end because it's unbearable. You cataracts and hurricanoes. Cataracts, the flood coming from down from the sky, water coming from the sky, hurricane, a water spout. It's not our sense of hurricane, but a water spout, water coming up from the sea. So it's a vision of water from above and water from below
spouting together until you can't tell where sea is, where sky is. It's like one of those Turner paintings from the 19th century, where it's just, you know, where's the sea, where's the sky, you know, who can tell? That's what the old man's calling for. Spout till you have drenched our steeples, drown the cocks. Let there be so much rain that the very steeples, and of course you say steeple and you instantly think of churches, until you have drenched the steeples, water all the way up to the top of the steeples. It's a call for universal destruction, and it is also a sign of his rage against the gods. Destroy their temples. Destroy the places where we have worshipped the gods. It's obviously no good. Look what they've done to me. Poor me, poor me. Therefore, let's destroy the temples of worship. And then that's not enough. We take it higher, because on the very top of the steeple you have the weathercock, the weather vane. Drown the cocks. No, take it up even further until that little bird that sits on top of all tall buildings telling you which way the wind is blowing is gone too, because we don't want to know the direction anything's coming from. Destroy that order too. So there's no longer any sign or symbol that can even indicate the most basic things, such as the direction of the wind. Use sulfurous and thought-executing fires. It's a wonderful line. He's referring to the lightning. The lightning, okay? He's calling on the lightning to come down. Sulfurous, if you've ever been around someplace where lightning has struck, there's a very heavy smell afterwards. But sulfurous for anybody, even back then, flames of hell. Flames of hell. The vision of it's lightning coming down, creating almost a kind of hell on earth, and thought executing fires. Lightning comes as quickly as we can think. Boom! There it was, and it's gone. But the words can also mean, and he'll say it later, hit me on the head and stop me from thinking. Execute my thoughts. I can't stand to think anymore. You sulfurous and thought-executing fires, vaunt couriers of oak-cleaving thunderbolts. Okay? You see the lightning, and then the thunder comes. But please notice, even as he's calling for destruction, he is aware instinctively and intuitively that there is order in nature. You can't have the thunder and then the lightning. No, no, no. The lightning comes first like a courier and announces, excuse me, thunder's on the way. And then sure enough, kaboom. There is order in nature. And the lightning is the courier that rides before the thunder announcing it's coming. And the thunderbolt, they used to call it that, the thunder is just that kaboom, is so magnificent, it should be so loud that it will literally break the oak in half. The mightiest of trees, the most solid of trees. And we have the vision of the tree just stripping apart, breaking apart. What's being destroyed? Nature itself again. Let's destroy nature. You sulfurous and thought-executing fires, vaunt couriers of oak-cleaving thunderbolts, singe my white head. It's the cocky young boxer in the ring. Right here, right here. Punch me right here, okay? Except it's the old man in the storm saying to the lightning, right here, right here. Hit me right here. But of course, he still doesn't want to suffer too much, because don't burn my white hair. Don't rend my, just singe it. Just do the corners of it. Just do it enough so I hurt. On second thought, I don't want you to rip my head apart. No, just singe my white head. And thou, all shaking thunder, strike flat the thick rotundity of the world. Now, wait a minute. Don't just cleave that oak. That was insufficient. I was thinking small. Excuse me. I was thinking small. No, as long as you're going to thunder, as long as you're going to be so huge as to shake everything, then strike flat the thick rotundity of the world. So we've got the world, which is round, and the thunder strikes, and squash! The world itself suddenly becomes flat as a pancake, because everything has been squashed out of it. And then we realize he's got something else in mind. Crack nature's molds. Where is nature molded? We've got a womb image again. We don't just have the cheeks of the wind, which were round, cracking. We don't just have the roundness of the world flattened. We now have the image of the pregnant woman. and the thunder will rip the mold of nature apart. It is horrifying. But we see what he's calling for because the image continues. All germens, all seeds, all germens spill at once that make ingrateful man. Let there be no more birth. Let's end it. And the vision of the squashing of the world leads to the image of the cracking of the womb and the sudden spilling of all the seed in the world at once that can never be fertile again. And there will never be another human being born, because to be born into the world and to be a man means to be ungrateful. Why? Because he hasn't been treated right. We have a single man calling for the destruction of all life and the destruction of the world because his daughters haven't given him what he wants. We have a monstrous ego that still has to be stripped down. But we also have majesty, and the fact of the matter is, and we know it, when human beings are pushed to the edge, they are capable of unbelievable destruction. Out of what? A very small wrong, or what may be seemingly an unimportant slight. Doesn't matter, the response will be overblown, because we have the will and the power and the fallen nature to create chaos and havoc in the world. Fortunately, by his side the fool. Oh, nuncle, court holy water in a dry house is better than this rainwater out a door. Good nuncle, in, ask thy daughter's blessing. Here's a night pities neither wise men nor fools. It's wet. Let's go inside. And if in the midst of this, little voice of sanity, little voice of reason, coming, of course, from the fool. Of course, Lear doesn't hear a word of it. Rumble thy belly full, spit fire, spout rain, nor rain, wind, thunder, fire are my daughters. I tax not you, you elements, with unkindness. I never gave you kingdom, called you children. You owe me no subscription. Why then, let fall your horrible pleasure. Look, it's wonderful. I'm not accusing you of anything. You never did me wrong. You're my friends. Don't take this personally. Here I stand, your slave, a poor, infirm, weak, and despised old man. And we get a moment of self-pity. Intense self-pity, although it's true. Everything he says is true. And the next line, switcho changeo. But yet, I call you, servile ministers, that will with two pernicious daughters join your high engendered battles against a head so old and white as this. Oh, tis false. No, I know what's it. You're working for them. You've joined with them, haven't you? This is a plot against me personally. And you see the rational mind breaking apart. This storm was arranged by the daughters. They all got together and decided, let's get the old man, we'll shut him out, and then you dump on him. Okay, that'll be good. It's a good plan. But we see the madness coming. We see the madness coming. Horrifying. Horrifying. The fool tries to sing a little song to quiet him down. And then Lear says, no, I will be the pattern of all patience. I will say nothing. Wait a minute. There's that word again. And who is he now echoing? Cordelia. Memories of Cordelia. I will say nothing. He's going stark raving mad. What hauls him back? What brings him back for a moment? The memory of Cordelia. He quotes her. He uses the word. This is the man who said, nothing will come of nothing. Well, yeah, here's the nothing that's come of it. staggering in size. Overpowering. I went through last night much of what goes on in the hovel. Let me just say this. I talked about language being redefined as the play goes along, and it does. But when we get to the storm, the fact of the matter is, it is a vision of a total collapse of almost everything. There is no civilized order. What appears to be civilized order is savage. Is savage, barbaric, and uncivilized. Language itself, which has been cracking and falling during the play, suddenly becomes nearly incomprehensible. My poor students come to me when they're trying to read this play and say, sir, I got to the middle of this play. I can't tell what's going on. This just gets crazy. And I say, yeah, that's right. That's right. Because Lear is raving, half mad and going mad. The fool's singing little ditties and making jokes, and half the time you don't know what he's talking about. And Edgar's coming out with remarkably insightful lines such as, the Prince of Darkness is a gentleman. Modo he's called, and Mahu. You know, what? That's one of my favorites. I mean, what on earth does that mean? And you have the three of them sitting around holding conversations. And the fact of the matter is, it is the descent into chaos. Absolute chaos. Chaos, social chaos, linguistic chaos, personal chaos. And there are only a few things one can hold on to, such as the fact that Kent is around, and that Gloucester is going to come out and try to help the old king. But it's not much. It's not much. And it is a vision of everything being tossed away on the whim of a foolish old man. And it's going to take this much to teach him the lessons. I'll tell you, it is indeed true. If you look at the enormity of suffering that Lear goes through, compared to the wrong, and it's a very real wrong, we again get the sense of Shakespeare's understanding of what it takes to beat common sense into a proud mind. And a heart that, well, I quote Solzhenitsyn again from last night, you know, a heart larded with pride. Just like that fat pig, just, you know, lard all over it. That is pride on the... How do you strip that away? What does it take? Well, it takes universal chaos. It takes a hurricane. It takes madness. It takes that much? Yes. And again, I go to Solzhenitsyn. What did it take to wake up many of those Russian people as to what was going on? They had to go to the camps and live through that. 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and some of them didn't make it out alive. And at the end, Solzhenitsyn will write the story of his life in those camps, and at the end of it, you have read unrelieved horror, chapter after chapter. You cannot believe human beings lived in this and survived. And he ends it by saying what? Bless you, prison, for having been in my life. Why? Because as he says, I knew nothing. I knew nothing. It was necessary that I be arrested, sent to the slave labor camps, undergo that horrific experience because it woke me up. It woke me up. I have a few minutes left. I want to leave some time for questions tonight because I cut it short last night. But let me do a kind of summary as to what's going on here. Because the Gulag reflects on King Lear as King Lear reflects on Oedipus Rex. We can leap the centuries and look at some of the greatest works of art, and they're telling us the same thing. I'll use Solzhenitsyn as a gloss on Lear. And since I don't have time to go through it in detail, let me just give a gloss in terms of what the rest of the play is about. And you can connect this with what I said last night. Solzhenitsyn talks about the fact, and Shakespeare includes this at the end of the play, that we get what we deserve. It's a frightening notion. He tells the story of a doctor who was hiding out in one of the little camp hospitals because he had been accused of being a rat, an informer. So he's hiding in the hospital because there are people out after him who want to kill him. And Solzhenitsyn sits up with him late one night, and this man tells him a little story and finally says, but I've come to learn something, and that is nothing on earth comes to us undeserved. If you look back over your life and you look at it carefully, you will find the reason in your past why you're being punished now. There is justice. Solzhenitsyn says the words laid on him, or just weighed him down for a long while, because they were the last words. The man was murdered that night with a mallet while he slept. And he said, but by that time I myself had matured to similar thoughts. There is nothing on this earth that comes to us that somehow we do not deserve. He says, however, then Then word comes in and says, but what about our so evident torturers, the guards? Why do they prosper? Why is everything seemingly comfortable for them while the rest of us are suffering? And he said, and the only answer to that would be that the secret to human life and the fact of why we're here is not to be comfortable, but to develop soul. And in this way, our torturers and our prison keepers are being tortured worse of all. They are sinking down to animals, to the level of animals. They are rapidly descending from the level of humanity. Suffering is given to those whose souls hold out hope, he says. There is the grisly moment near the end of the play where Edgar, who by the way goes through his transformations, having lost his identity, becoming essentially an animal, then becoming a madman, then pretending to be a peasant, and then shows up as a knight in armor to fight his brother. Okay? And that progression is a deliberate one. Comes in at the end, wins the battle, and Edmund says, look, I admit it, you got me, you killed me, but who are you? Who are you? I want to know who you are. Reason being, let me quote it exactly. What art thou that hast this fortune on me? Who are you that beat me? Who are you? You won the battle. Who are you? If thou art noble, I do forgive thee. This guy who claimed to stand for nature comes to the end. He's been defeated. He's been killed. And he says what? Boy, I hope you were at least a nobleman. I hope I'm not being killed by some jerk peasant. And what we see is even in the bastard was an innate sense of nobility and the importance of nobility, you know. Look, if I'm going to be run down in the street, I hope it's by a Cadillac or a Lincoln Continental. I hope it's not a 1955 Volkswagen Bug that just sort of squashes me. There's got to be some dignity here, please. And Edgar says, "Let's exchange charity. I am no less in blood than thou art, Edmund." He compliments his brother. If I'm more in blood than you, the more thou hast wronged me. It may be I'm a better man in blood than you. If that's the case, you've really wronged me. But notice the last words of brother to brother, and it's been brother against brother. It's that Cain and Abel plot that haunted Shakespeare. Old Hamlet, Claudius, Edmund, Edgar, okay? You've wronged me, but I'll be charitable. My name is Edgar, and thy father's son. The gods are just, and of our pleasant vices make instruments to plague us. That dark and vicious place where thee he got cost him his eyes. Whew. Horrifying notion. Edgar stayed with his father, cared for his father, is there when his father dies, but says, that wrong he did in conceiving you out of wedlock those many years ago cost him his eyes. And in that we see the gods are just. It is a stern, harsh justice, but the notion is there is justice. That justice is there. But it is the justice, again, of suffering. And our vision of the final moments of Gloucester are given to us. Edgar runs through the story, explains what has happened, and says, I didn't reveal myself to him. I didn't tell him who I was until some half hour passed when I was armed. Not sure, though hoping of this good success, I asked his blessing. We have Lear kneeling to Cordelia, Cordelia kneeling to Lear, Edgar kneeling to his father, asking his blessing before he goes into battle to do what? Kill the bastard son. And from first to last told him our pilgrimage, but his flawed heart, alack, too weak the conflict to support, twixt two extremes of passion, joy and grief burst smilingly. Can't even comment on that. It's absolutely overwhelming. Absolutely overwhelming. But Edgar says, our father got justice. They haul in the two corpses of Goneril and Regan. Murder-suicide. Right out of today's papers. Edmund looks at the bodies and says, yet Edmund was beloved. They won the other poison for my sake and after slew herself. They did this for me? You mean somebody loved me? Oh! This whole thing was about what? The outsider, the cast-off, the one who didn't think he was loved, who now will take as sufficient signs of love in a murder-suicide between the two sisters who both wanted him? Oh, I mean, the ending of this play, before we even get to Lear coming in with the dead Cordelia, is so painful as to be almost unendurable. But I reiterate Solzhenitsyn's point. Suffering is reserved for those whose souls hold out hope. And who has suffered the most in this play? Gloucester, Edgar, Cordelia, Kent, and Lear most of all. And in one sense, you can look at the play and say, how horrific, how horrible, and there are many who do that. And in fact, there are many 20th century interpretations of this play that say it's all meaningless, there's no point to it. But there is another way in which, if you have any Catholic sense at all, you have to look at the play and say, Lear has been blessed by suffering. Cordelia has been blessed by being allowed to sacrifice herself in love for her father. It is simply not the blessing that we assume we want or need, but then it's not our will that is to be done. And it is not our path that should be arranged, or that we can arrange on our own. It is the decision of Providence, and we must take what Providence sends. And the surest sign, if you will, that Lear possesses greatness is that he suffers, and does indeed. If he called for patience at the beginning, he has at least been given perseverance. Edgar's line, the oldest hath borne most. How has this man lasted this long? But he did. And he lasted long enough to learn the final lesson, which was what? That his daughter could die. Is it a catastrophe? Only from one point of view. It is a real loss. But what does he learn by the death of Cordelia? When he awakens in the reconciliation scene, when they are reunited, he thinks he is in heaven and that Cordelia is an angel. What he finds out by the end of Act 5 is something more mysterious. She is not an angel. She is flesh and blood. And she proves it by giving up her flesh and giving up her blood for her father. And that sacrifice from a human being out of love is a great sign of a divine plan that can only make sense if it has a higher purpose. I said when I began the talks that there was a reason, I think, and a kind of logic on this great feast day to talk about King Lear. And in order, I think, to make the connection, we have to see that even in the sacrifice and the suffering and the loss and the death of a Cordelia who proves herself human, we are in touch with the possibility of sainthood and an understanding of what can make a saint. And that is love that transcends the human world as we know it and is far above nature, that promises something higher. That promise is not fulfilled in Lear, but it's hinted at. And everything is in place in Lear to suggest something much grander and much greater to follow. Thank you very much. Got a few minutes here. Feel free, anything.
Is there any reason why in Lear the hero is not, so to say, killed violently, while in the other tragedies the hero is?
I think so, and it is indeed that vision of wearing out. And the idea is repeated over and over. In the last time we see Edgar with his father, Edgar says, rest here by the tree, there's a big battle going on, I'll be back for you. And then he comes running in and says, oh, you know, Lear and his daughter lost. Come on, old man, we've got to go. And Gloucester says, no, a man may rot even here. No, don't make me go any further. And he says, and Edgar replies by saying, a man must endure his going hence even as his coming hither. Ripeness is all. I'm sorry, you can't rest. There's more to this story. There's more to come. And Gloucester gets up and leaves saying, and that's true too. He acknowledges a truth told to him by his son. He still doesn't know it's his son, but the notion is you've got to do what? You've got to keep going. It's not our decision. It's the reason for the phony suicide. That grotesque trick that Edgar plays on his father. Gloucester repeatedly during the last acts of the play wants out of it all and is tempted to suicide. Edgar says, okay, well, I'll set it up for him. But instead what he does, he just lets his father knock himself out and comes to and then says, oh, thy life's a miracle. Yeah, you fell off the cliff. You fell all this way. You're still alive. It's a miracle. To reintroduce the notion of number one, you know, it is a miracle he's still alive. Kent in the stocks gets the letter from Cordelia in France and says, nothing almost sees miracles but misery. You've got to be at the lowest point to even begin to grasp that a miracle has taken place. But if you're at the lowest point, simple things can become miraculous. And what happens is Gloucester goes on, Lear goes on and on and on. Until finally the kindest thing, and there's some people that have questioned the line, I don't think it's fair, the last thing that Kent says about Lear is, vex not his ghost. He hates him that on the rack of this tough world would stretch him out longer. I mean, just please, finally, the old man is done. There's nothing more. But the vision in the play is perseverance. Just going on and on and on. And it's clear what happens at the end is, you're right, not a violent death. Hamlet stabbed, Macbeth's head cut off, you know, Othello committing suicide with the sword. Lear has a heart attack. Lear's body just finally gives out. And we know it's coming that moment. It's heartbreaking right near the end. He suddenly turns and just simply says, pray you undo this button. And apparently the button holding his shirt or his gown closed, the heart's rising up to the point where he thinks the clothing's too tight. What's happening is his heart's about to burst, the way Gloucester's heart burst. Lear himself, in a sense, his heart bursts smilingly. Those last lines, he looks at Cordelia and sees something. Look on her lips. Look there. He's been trying to find some sign of life. And then suddenly he seems to see something that nobody else, the others don't see. We certainly don't see it. And then boom, he's gone. But he lasted a long time, longer than it could be imagined he could last. The notion is in the play is you must simply keep going. It's a lesson in perseverance. There is a reason, and it's not our reason. We have no business deciding. It flies in the face again of the modern world's notion, I'm in misery, I'm unhappy, therefore call Kevorkian. Put an end to it. I don't want to suffer. This play flies in the face of that. And I'll go back to Oedipus, I'll go to Lear, and then up to Gulag Archipelago. Sophocles, Shakespeare, Solzhenitsyn, what do they say to us? You damn well better suffer. That's what you're here for. That's the reason you're here. And it's the only way you will attain wisdom, and there is a purpose to it. And if three men from three such different ages and cultures, in three stupendous works of art, can come up with that same idea, then there must be something to it and needs to be taken seriously. Certainly more seriously than Kevorkian or the whims of a poor unfortunate that is suffering. But the modern world has no way of explaining suffering other than to say, get rid of it. And if it means that, well, you have to do yourself in, well, then so be it. And the courts have no business standing in your way. I mean, we all know it's coming. It's inevitable. It's just a matter of time. It's popping up everywhere. It's happening. It's another one of those modern insanities. One of those modern insanities. And this is not to say that we want to suffer. Okay? Everything in us fights against it, of course. But there it is. It's a fact. And there is a purpose for it. There's a purpose for it. Yeah.
Why does Edmund say to Edgar that he forgives him if Edgar is really the one who is destroying all his opportunities
at rising up? It's very interesting. Wait, Edgar forgives Edmund, you mean? Or vice versa?
No, Edmund says, if thou art noble,
I do. Oh, if thou art noble, I do forgive thee. There are a couple of moments. Again, Shakespeare will not paint a villain who is completely black. There's always humanity there. And it comes in a couple of curious ways with Edmund at the beginning. Edmund, Edmund is one of those roles. It's a great role. He has a touch of Richard III. He has a touch of Iago. He's funny. And during his opening scenes, he's quite funny. And he doesn't stop being funny until he grabs for power, which is always the case with the Shakespearean villain. And suddenly they're not funny anymore. But even then, in the final moment, Shakespeare will grant them some humanity. And the humanity in Edmund comes in two ways. One, the sense of even being able to conceive of forgiveness. And number two, the notion of being able to see love in the most bizarre place. Now, it's not love. It's false love. But he couldn't believe anyone would ever care for him. And at that moment, it's almost, we see the pain that's been in this man. What created the what made him the monster that he has been? And it's, whose fault is it? It goes back to Gloucester's. It's Gloucester's fault. It's painful. Those are, they're odd moments, but what do you get? Edmund is more human in a sense at the moment of death. More human at the moment of death.
Why is there no opera over there?
Some have tried and failed. There is a contemporary German composer named Reimann who did an opera of Lear that was around for a while, but it was 12-tone and ugly and, you know, one of those things that wouldn't hold the boards anyway. Part of it, I think, is during the great era of opera, the play was most known in its phony version with a happy ending. There's only one composer who seriously tried it, and that was Verdi. Verdi spent his whole lifetime talking about writing an opera of Lear, but never did. There were sketches he made for it, but it was his favorite Shakespeare play, but he never got around to composing it. It just didn't happen. It's interesting, especially because Verdi had the same fascination for fathers and daughters that Shakespeare did. Shows up in Rigoletto, Simon Boccanegra, a number of places. So in a way, it would have been a natural subject for him, but he never did it. He never did it. I think it's too big. I think it's simply too big. The only thing we have is a King Lear overture by Berlioz that's okay, but not worthy of the subject. But then there's a sense, as soon as you hit Lear, almost anything you say or think about it is unworthy of the subject. The play's just that much bigger than anything we can say about it. There is a great sonnet by Keats called On Sitting Down to Read King Lear Once Again. It's probably the best tribute to the play. But musically, nothing has been done. Yeah.
In that sonnet, he makes reference to this dispute between Passion and Clay. What are those?
Between Damnation and Impassioned Clay. It is I would simply say it's a vision of the battle between spirit and flesh. But it is, as Keats puts it, a very dark vision. The Romantics had a very dark vision of this play. So that if there's a sort of a spiritual life, it tends towards damnation. If there is clay, which is the flesh, it's cursed with passions. And the two are battling. Flesh and spirit are battling. But the outcome can't be anything high or noble or grand. It's this dreadful clash.
So he would have had the tragic ending.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because the romantic poets, if they had gone to the theater to see it performed, would have seen the crummy happy ending version. But they probably didn't go to the theater. They read it. Lear, interestingly enough, has not really become a popular stage piece until our own time. Within the last 40 or 50 years, Lear has become not just stage-worthy, but done as often as the other great tragedies. And that's new. And I think the reason is because we've caught up with it. When I teach it, I tell my classes, I think we're somewhere sort of end of Act 2, heading into Act 3. And I tell them quite honestly, prepare for it. You will all be crawling around in the mud and the slime and the dirt and horror and in the midst of madness and chaos very soon. And then they get upset with me.
Does Cordelia have any imperfections?
She has a bit of her father's stubbornness. And you get a little sense of that in the opening scene. I mean, the response of nothing, my lord, is a little stern and a little, you know, There might have been a nicer way to put it, okay? But given the circumstances, we sort of understand. But that sort of little bit of stubbornness is also what clearly gives her fortitude to come back and fight for him. So if it's an imperfection, it's an imperfection that links her with her father, and that she in a way uses for a kind of that gets transformed into a good. But I'd call it a small one. In fact, Lear says, "Oh, most small fault." How large did thou and Cordelia show? And it's a little fault, but it's not much. Certainly not compared to what is going on around him and what he himself is doing. Tiny, tiny. Yeah. Thank you.